The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And now to the authenticity question in politics. Here's David Plotz, host of Slate's Political Gabfest podcast, speaking with guest Julia Yoffe about candidate Hillary Clinton.
She seems to be running a very analogous campaign to the one she ran in 2007-2008, where she's super stilted, very cautious, very scared of the press, and being very calculated about, you know, how much of her real self she lets show.
But what is it? What do you even mean, her real self? Like, why is it important to identify a real self?
You would think she would have learned that lesson, that she should at least put on a good show of authenticity. But she's still, you know, she's still like, oh no, I'm just learning it right now, and I will start later.
Clinton is just one of many contenders who's been fighting to appear authentic in the eyes of the media and American voters, pushing against the stuffy, snobbish insider persona that's become especially reviled in this election cycle and given non-politicians an edge. But what does authentic really mean in politics? Well, not that much, according to University of Denver political scientist Seth Maskett. Seth is also a columnist for Pacific Standard magazine, where he's been writing about the role authenticity plays in politics. And Seth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
American voters and the media now seem to be obsessed with authenticity. What does that mean?
Well, we're not really sure what it means, but it doesn't seem to mean the word authentic in any sense. And that is, you know, when we hear reporters using, as in that clip, the term put on a show of authenticity. Authentic, at least my impression, is that it's supposed to mean whatever the person really is. And here we're talking about someone basically they needing to put on a show, to portray something that they may not already be, and that will be considered authentic.
Which makes me wonder. I mean, authentic suggests a person who's maybe human, you know, has cranky moments, gets tired, maybe stumbles. So do people, voters, really want authenticity?
It's not clear that they do. I mean, it's really difficult to test this, of course. I mean, it's hard to go back in time and just sort of say, well, which presidential candidates were actually authentic, and we could see whether the authentic candidate won or not. I mean, the problem with it is that it's a word we tend to impose retroactively on past elections and say, well, George W. Bush beat Al Gore because he was the more authentic candidate. But, you know, at the time, you could make a case that either one of them had authenticity problems in that, you know, they were both Yale-educated, Harvard-educated, sons of wealthy politicians, who were both affecting Southern accents to win an election. And one of them happened to get a few more votes, or at least a few more electoral votes than the other. It's not necessarily that, you know, voters preferred one over the other because they believed his story more. There's, you know, other parts of elections that seem to be much more convincing, like the state of the economy or who's perceived as a moderate or an extremist.
Here's another moment that's been pointed out as especially genuine on the campaign trail. Well, not quite the campaign trail in this case. Joe Biden speaking with Stephen Colbert last week.
I don't think any man or woman should run for president unless, number one, they know exactly why they would want to be president, and two, they can look at the folks out there and say, I promise you, you have my whole heart, my whole soul, my energy, and my passion to do this. And I'd be lying if I said that I knew I was there. I'm being completely honest.
Well, that moment won a lot of people over, including the columnist David Brooks, who says, yes, he should run for president. He's so genuine, authentic, by saying that he couldn't possibly run and be authentic. So this creates this kind of circular problem. They're politicians at heart who have to convince Americans that they have no desire to be part of a system that voters love to hate. What's going on?
Exactly. Yeah, part of the problem is that, you know, we have an instinctive distrust for politicians. And so anyone who tells you they don't want to be a part of the system, we immediately think, aha, they need to be part of the system, which creates sort of a problem. The other side of it is that when you're running for office in a democracy, you know, the idea is to win a great many votes. And that means, you know, winning over people who believe different things. And so candidates who are seriously in the game and trying to do it, they will try very hard to not offend a lot of potential voters. And in their effort not to do that, it can sound like they're not saying what they really mean. And they're not necessarily lying to us. They're simply trying to put together a large coalition of people. But to some, that sounds inauthentic. It sounds like they're putting on a show when we really want to hear what they truly believe. But of course, it's not always clear what someone really believes or what someone really is. There's not just one thing that Hillary Clinton exactly is, or there's not just one thing that any given voter really is. We're a wide range of beliefs and backgrounds.
But hasn't offensiveness and saying outlandish things in this particular election been regarded as particularly authentic? You know, that Donald Trump says what he really means. He's not afraid of anybody. So when he talks about, you know, Mexican immigrants being rapists and drug dealers, well, he's just telling it like it is.
Yeah, well, there's sort of a creepy side to the authenticity debate where, you know, Donald Trump will get credit for being quote-unquote authentic because he's not quote-unquote politically correct, which means he is not constrained at all by politeness. And there's a certain segment of the population that, you know, feels similarly. They feel, you know, hey, I shouldn't have to be constrained by that either. I prefer talking about people the way I did 50 years ago. And that's, you know, that's sort of a disturbing side of it. That's kind of appealing to a certain set of older, more racially conservative white voters. And, you know, in that sense, authenticity can be kind of a code word, not necessarily for out-and-out racism, but for a certain worldview that, you know, in many ways, the rest of the electorate is trying to move past.
Well, the kind of qualities that politicians try to display in an effort to appear authentic, many have very little to do with holding office. So how did this come to the forefront of political campaigning?
I mean, in a real sense, it's always been there in American politics. You know, you can see campaigns in the 1800s about candidates, you know, proudly portraying their past of growing up in a log cabin and you know, not being about pretense, not being, you know, part of the stuffy upper class or part of the Washington insider crowd. You know, that's in many ways, I mean, you can say Andrew Jackson was running a similar campaign in the 1820s. He was trying to appear authentic. He was someone who would, you know, drink cider and kill Native Americans. And in some ways that appealed to a certain segment of the population as being, yeah, this is a real person. This is not a regular politician. So I think that's always been there. It's probably taken on a bit more of a role this year than in many, simply because of the presence of Trump and journalists and other politicians trying to come up with ways of explaining his, not only his early popularity, but sort of longstanding popularity, how his the sort of bubble has remained unpopped for several months now.
You do remind us in your most recent column that Hillary Clinton has been living in the public eye for more than two decades now. But people keep throwing questions like, is she being authentic? Is he, but really mostly she? Does this obsession with authenticity apply to women more than men?
That is something I wonder, and we don't have a lot of sense of this at the presidential level. I mean, there simply haven't been that many female presidential candidates who have come this close to the office before. But, you know, if you look at maybe, you know, congressional candidates, I think of like Patty Murray or Tammy Duckworth, These are certainly candidates who one might think of as authentic in the sense that, you know, they've had sort of real life experiences. They're not necessarily lifelong politicians. But at the presidential level, it might be different. Hillary Clinton has been labeled as inauthentic several times that she's run and in several other places throughout her political life. And that may just be directed at her because she's her. It may be directed at her because she's a woman. We don't have a great many cases to look at.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign announced that it's going to start being more spontaneous and fun. You know, sounds a little bit like planning spontaneity. So what do you think, Seth Masket? Good show of authenticity?
Well, I mean, I think it's challenging for female candidates. It's particularly challenging for Hillary Clinton running for president. I mean, we saw lots of examples of this in 2008 where she was always trying to sort of thread the needle between being seen as too masculine and too feminine, between as too emotional or too unemotional. No matter what she did, she was getting criticized for being too much of one thing and not the other. So, you know, she was criticized as being too calculating and too unemotional. And then we saw right before the New Hampshire primary in 08, a display of emotion, a sort of a spontaneous bit of crying in an interview at a diner. And actually, voters seemed to resonate to that somewhat. Her approval ratings went up. She actually went on to win that primary. But then there were concerns that, oh, well, maybe this isn't appropriate for a president to be crying. And so then she had to move in the other direction. It places a lot of pressure on her to try and show who she really is, even though she basically is who she is. We've been seeing her publicly for more than 20 years now. We have a pretty good sense of what her personality is.
Well, Seth, thank you for speaking with us today.
It's been good talking to you. Thank you.
Seth Masket, political scientist at the University of Denver and author of No Middle Ground, How Informal Party Organizations Control Nominations and Polarize Legislatures, and columnist for Pacific Standard Magazine, where we read several of his columns about the role of authenticity in politics.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard from one political scientist who says that authenticity in politics is the stuff of legends. However loaded the term is during campaign season, authentic is habitually used when it comes to food. Its meaning and use in the restaurant industry is so uncertain that longtime food critic Bill Addison refers to it as the A-word. Bill is restaurant editor for Eater. Producers Molly Donahue and Taylor Quimby spoke to him about the riddle of authentic cuisine.
So, Bill, I'm going to give you a little riddle, actually. We're going to start. I want you to picture walking down a street in some New England town, and you see a restaurant, let's call it Los Amigos, and it says, authentic Mexican cuisine. Now, what do you think that means?
Well, I think it doesn't mean much of anything, really, probably. But what I think they're trying to get across is that if you eat here, you'll understand the real flavors of Mexico. And I have several questions when I see a sign like that. First of all, there is no one real, quote, authentic Mexican cooking, unquote. There are cuisines in Mexico, plural.
Right.
And cuisines that come down not to just a region, but a town, a neighborhood, a household. So I actually sort of cringe when I see that word authentic splashed across a restaurant's facade.
So it sort of seems like the word has been co-opted. You know, big companies use authentic to mean something even less significant.
Yeah. Like, what, you know, when you see it on, like, frozen food.
Right. And it's funny because America's had such a funny swing in culture over the last 50 years around food. And by funny, I mean peculiar and fascinating. Not actually funny. You know, maybe in the 1950s, we were as a culture so myopic that we wanted food that sounded perhaps exotic, but was really familiar to our palate with just a little hint of exoticism in some way, you know, a fondue pot or a splash of cumin to mean Mexican food. But as Americans have taken more of an interest in food, this word authenticity and authentic has become much more enticing. We want to believe that there's somebody's grandmother back there cooking the food that she grew up with in a small town in a faraway country. And so the corporate giants have seen that, and so they have absolutely co-opted this word authentic to broadcast, hey, you know, you're getting the real deal when you buy this food product from us.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, when I was thinking about the, you know, you're walking down the street, you see a Mexican restaurant, it says authentic Mexican cuisine, I start thinking about all the different things it could mean. You know, you sort of talk about the recipe, the tradition, but like you mentioned, there's also the people who are cooking it, like, are they authentically Mexican? And then there's even like, is this stuff sourced from Mexico? So it could be about an ingredient list.
Even if it meets all those qualifications, it's not even authentic enough for some people.
Yeah.
Right. And yes, exactly. So there's A, is the cook in the back, even if they are Latino or, you know, of Hispanic origin, are they cooking recipes like they themselves would cook for their family, or are they adopting things to the perceived clientele? And then conversely, is the clientele buying into the fact that it's authentic, or are they resentful that it's not Oaxacan cuisine or Baja, you know, food? It's just, yeah, the mind can go round and round and round and round on this stuff.
It's a total can of worms.
So do you think there is food that can be 100% authentic?
No, I think that when it comes to food, that generally authenticity is a myth. I think that, you know, part of the romance of food writing these days is food writers and television personalities traveling to the source for these kinds of dishes that we're all curious about, whether it be Japan or Lebanon or, you know, Oaxaca. And I think that if you take food out of its place of origin, if you're not cooking it with the food grown in the soil around where this recipe evolved, or if you're not cooking it in a family setting where maybe there are multiple contributions to the recipe, or something that's passed down by word of mouth and you're trying to translate it into a professional kitchen, I think the whole subject of authenticity can be lost in all that.
We read your article, Magical Realism, about going to Disney World, and it really made you question the meaning of authentic food. So as a food critic, where do you stand on Disney cuisine?
What I find fascinating about Disney, it is the microcosm for thinking about this subject of authenticity and food. Three of us from Eater went down to do a big package covering sort of every angle food-wise of Disney World. And while we were particularly wandering around Epcot, you know, we found ourselves always questioning, like, how, you know, close to the source was this Chinese dish? How true to Canada was the poutine, which is a snack of fries with gravy and cheese curds on top? I was there for 5 days of research and ordered food at about 53 different establishments, which
wow.
Yeah, one of the hardest. It felt military at the end. It was one of the hardest assignments I've ever had. But what I began to appreciate, you know, of course not everything is going to be quote-unquote authentic at Disney World, but I do appreciate that Epcot, in particular at Disney World, can open a window of curiosity. When I was a kid myself, and I went there in the 80s, I ate the French food in the France Pavilion, and I was curious to go to France myself because something about the food, the crunch of the baguette or the unctuousness of the French onion soup made me want to try those things at the source. And so I guess that's my greatest hope for people visiting Disney. You know, for a lot of people, their encounters at Morocco or China or Japan may be as close as those countries countries that they ever get.
So maybe then let me pose like an alternative interpretation for the word. Maybe it's not so much about any of those specific qualities that we talked about as it is about like an experience. Like if you have an authentic experience, like you feel like you walked away having eaten Mexican food and it felt, you know, it felt like an authentic moment. That's what we're going for.
I think so. I like to use the word, you know, the other thing is, of course, like we just said, you know, even as I, as a food critic, I'm always chasing something that's as close to the source as possible when we're talking about global foods or even foods from the South where I live. You know, does something taste authentically of Cajun cuisine in Louisiana? Does it taste of Creole cuisine right in New Orleans? So I like to use the phrase true-minded instead of authentic when I'm writing about these kinds of foods, because I think that gets more to the point that somebody is looking for the most accurate, honest sense of cooking a dish and experiencing it.
And that was the food critic Bill Addison speaking with producers Molly Donahue and Taylor Quimby. Addison is restaurant editor at Eater. And you'll find a link to read his piece about authenticity and Disney cuisine at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each holiday shopping season, manufacturers and marketers vie for the prize of becoming the year's most sought-after toy. And it's not easy to predict what will capture the hearts of children and open the pocketbooks of their parents. Who could have guessed the rush for the Slinky or the Hula Hoop or the runaway hit of 1996, Tickle Me Elmo? But for every success story, there are hundreds of flops that never make it off the shelves and are destined for obscurity. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible and producer John Milwellum bring us the origin story of the now universal teddy bear and its not-so-successful successor.
It's totally unfair. Hydrox cookies came out in 1908. Oreos didn't show up until 4 years later. But it didn't matter. Hydrox could never shake the image of being a knockoff, and also ran. Hydrox lovers would champion its tangier cream filling. Vegetarians would praise them for being cruelty-free, while America's favorite cookie, the Oreo, contained animal lard until the mid-90s. As a consumer product, it's just not up to you. Sometimes you're deemed the mighty transformer, and sometimes you're the loathsome GoBot.
One shall stand, and one shall fall.
It's capricious who wins. Swiss cake roll versus ho-ho, Twizzler versus red vine. Maybe yours was the first family on the block with the technologically superior Betamax player, only to be overwhelmed by the mediocre VHS tape. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense at all. But sometimes it does.
I'm John Mualim.
John is a writer for the New York Times Magazine and a writer at large for Pop-Up Magazine,
the live magazine in San Francisco,
where this story first appeared.
Right, so it's 1902, and Theodore Roosevelt is president.
And he decides to vacation in a town called Smeads in the Mississippi woods, where he can hunt black bear.
He's a big outdoorsman, big hunter.
And this hunting trip became kind of a famous story.
Basically, he had spent a few days hunting, and I don't think they even saw a single bear. They definitely didn't get to shoot at any. And then one morning, the dogs get the scent of a bear, and they follow it down into this really weedy place where the president's guide says, you know what, don't even bother going in there and troubling yourself. I'll go in and I'll flush the bear out. You just stay here and I'll flush it right to you.
So Roosevelt waits and waits, but then he gets bored and decides to go off and eat lunch.
Eventually, the dogs do corner the bear, and the guide, not really knowing what to do, leaps off his horse, cracks the bear over the head with the butt of his rifle, knocks it unconscious or semi-unconscious, and ties it to a tree, and then starts blowing away on his bugle, trying to call Roosevelt back so that the president can be the one who has the honor of shooting it.
Roosevelt hears the bugle and makes his way back to the hunting party.
And what he finds is this bear. It's a female bear. It weighs about 235 pounds, and it's tied to a tree. It's still semi-conscious, it's injured, it looks a little mangy. It's actually probably about half as heavy and big as it should be, but there's been a real drought going on in the area.
The bear looks pathetic. and Roosevelt takes pity on it.
He decides that it's unsportsmanlike to shoot this thing. You know, he's not going to do it, and he doesn't want anyone else to do it either. So he lowers his gun, and in this sort of merciful moment is, you know, word of this spreads, and a political cartoonist draws a cartoon of the moment of him, you know, showing the bear this mercy. And the way the cartoonist draws the bear is almost like a little Labrador puppy or a golden retriever puppy. It's sort of on its butt and its hind legs, and it's got these big round perked up ears, almost like Mickey Mouse, and these big wide eyes, and it's staring at the president, waiting to see what its fate will be.
The cartoon was called Drawing the Line in Mississippi.
And from that basically spawned the teddy bear. This adorable little bear in the cartoon was turned into a three-dimensional plush toy.
The very first teddy bear was either made by a German company called Stief or a Brooklyn toy store owner, depending on who you ask.
And they name it after Theodore Roosevelt. They call it Teddy's Bear.
It's a huge sensation.
And it's actually more popular than baby dolls, which freaks everyone out a little bit. You know, why should their children be playing with bears and not dolls? It's a little savage. And within a few years, I think Steve is producing close to 1 million teddy bears a year and shipping them to the U.S.
But it was considered so bizarre that kids would play with a stuffed bear that people just assumed it was a novelty. And as soon as Roosevelt left office, no one would want them anymore.
And at this time, the whole idea of mass-produced toys was also really new. So the toy industry wanted to kind of capitalize on its rally and keep it going. So it was really looking for whatever was going to be the next cuddly plaything that American kids were going to want, although it had no idea what that might be.
So fast forward to 1909. And Roosevelt's term is about up, and the president-elect is Roosevelt's hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft.
And that January 1909, Taft is in Atlanta. He's trying to woo the South, try to convince him that his administration is going to, you know, take them seriously as a constituency. And he's the guest of honor at this banquet.
And the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta decides it's going to serve him the truest, most unpretentious Southern dish around.
It's something that a writer of the time, I found this little book about Southern food from the time, calls it the Christmas goose of the Epicurean Negro.
The meal was possum and taters.
And what it was an opossum would be roasted on a bed of sweet potatoes and then presented whole on a platter with its head on, its tail on, and it, often you'd get a smaller little sweet potato crammed between the animal's teeth. 50 teeth.
By the way, 50 teeth is apparently the most teeth of any North American mammal.
Which is fascinating. In the end, the one that they brought to Taft's table weighed 18 pounds. All of a sudden, the orchestra strikes up and the guests burst into song. Suddenly, Taft is presented with this surprise gift, and it's a small, stuffed opossum toy.
And this is a brand new invention that some local Taft supporters are trying to position as William Taft's presidency's answer to the teddy bear.
They're calling it the Billy Possum. Already there was a company set up called the Georgia Billy Possum Company. According to one account, within 24 hours of that banquet, there were already deals being brokered for Billy Possums with distributors across the country. In covering the banquet, the LA Times announced that the teddy bear has been relegated to a seat in the rear, and for 4 years, possibly eight, the children of the United States will play with Billy Possums.
So from then on, a bit of possum mania started. There were Billy Possum postcards,
Billy Possum pins, Billy Possum pictures for your cream when you had coffee. There was a ragtime tune called Possum, the Latest Craze. And as Taft traveled around the South, some people actually started giving him live opossums in cages when he would make public appearances, sort of handing them over like they were floral bouquets.
Soon, Billy Possums were in toy stores from New York to San Francisco.
Because real opossums weren't actually that common in cities then, and no one really knew what they were, a toy store in Brooklyn ran an in-store promotion with a live captive opossum that they could show off to kids so the kids could familiarize themselves with what this new animal they were going to be best friends with was. I found an advertisement for the store that read, "Do not let it be said that any man, woman, or child in Brooklyn has not seen the cute little animal whose name is mentioned more in all parts of the world today than any other." Previously, there had been poems in newspapers sort of mourning the passing of the dolls and how sad it was that these teddy bears were coming into nurseries and vanquishing them. And now there were poems in newspapers about Billy Possums displacing teddy bears.
But since you probably never heard of a Billy Possum,
you can guess what comes next.
It was a total flop, and the Billy Possum was forgotten and almost entirely out of stores within a couple of months. So in other words, the Billy Possum never even made it to see Christmas time, which is a special kind of tragedy for a toy.
There are several possible explanations as to why the Billy Possum never took off. The first, and probably what you're thinking right now, is this. Opossums are ugly, and nobody likes them. But it was also the dawn of the mechanical toy, and even some teddy bears had evolved into wind-up animatrons.
There was a French-made teddy bear that, quote, winds up and is calculated to indulge in a number of ludicrous somersaults.
How could a limp, stuffed Billy Possum compete with that? But John Mooallem argues that, at its heart, the acceptance of teddy bear and the rejection of Billy Possum comes down to their origin stories.
In the story that was told about Roosevelt and this bear, it was a very kind of tender moment where Roosevelt was showing the bear mercy. And when you looked at that cartoon, the way the bear was drawn, it looked like something that you would want to just sweep up into your arms and take care of, and that was vulnerable and that needed your help.
It looked like a teddy bear as we know it, although no one knew it at the time.
The story with Taft, it didn't give it anything else. You know, Taft ate his opossum for supper, and he ate a lot of it, and he ate so much that after his first several helpings, a doctor seated nearby apparently passed him a note suggesting that it might be a good idea if he slowed down a little.
Taft even bragged to reporters the next day about how much possum he consumed.
Well, I like opossum, and I ate very heartily of it last night, and it did not disturb in the slightest my digestion or my sleep.
The possum was vulnerable, I guess, splayed out on a bed of taters, but you're not exactly rooting for it.
I started feeling really bad for Taft, who, you know, the more I read a little bit about him, he was this totally colorless politician, and he didn't actually even want to be president by some accounts. He was sort of strong-armed into it by Roosevelt, and he never really measured up to Roosevelt's charisma and charm. I mean, Roosevelt was the kind of guy who, you know, no matter what he did, history seemed eager to glorify him for it.
Case in point, the messed up thing about the famous story of Teddy's bear on that hunting trip in Mississippi is it isn't even the whole truth.
You have to remember that Roosevelt was a hunter. He was there to hunt bears. He wasn't a PETA activist or something like this. While he did show the bear mercy, it was a very particular kind of mercy. After he refused to shoot it, he said, "Put it out of its misery." And then one of his hunting buddies came in and slit the bear's neck open with a knife. They carried the bear's body back to camp over the back of a horse, and they basically ate off it for the next several days. And on the last night of their trip, they finished it off. They roasted its paws, and I kid you not, they ate the paws with a side of possum and taters.
So that's why you will never cuddle up with a Billy Possum. Just like you will never watch a Betamax tape or travel to Gobatron with Leader One. And you will never again dunk a Hydrox cookie. Man, I miss Hydrox cookies. Well, they were really tasty.
That story was produced by Roman Mars and John Mooallem for the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2012, a Canadian trauma surgeon was hit by a drunk driver and rushed to the hospital. She was pregnant with her 11th child and died shortly after the baby was delivered by emergency delivery. It was Mother's Day. The tragic death of Dana Durr is one of the saddest stories you'd ever hear, and thousands of friends and supporters were stricken with grief after her husband posted the news on social media. But Dana, her husband, and their 11 children never existed. They were the invention of a medical student in her young 20s. Taryn Wright is a futures trader by day and internet hoax buster by night. She helped to uncover what is now referred to the Warrior Eli hoax and joins us to talk about the phenomenon sometimes referred to as Munchausen by internet. Taryn, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So how did you uncover this hoax?
I was actually just, it was Mother's Day. I went on Facebook and one of my friends had posted about it. And I read the post that was linked by her, and I just thought, oh my gosh, this is the saddest story. I'm very nosy, so I did a little Google search just to see what the people involved look like and noticed that there were no Google News results, which, I mean, the news media would have been all over that, a young mother dying on Mother's Day in a drunk driving accident. So that kind of is what made me suspicious of the whole thing.
Okay, so who's this Eli character that comes into it?
Eli was the Durr's young son who was, I believe, 7, and he was just slowly dying of cancer. And the family had kind of documented it in graphic detail on all their social media sites. They were on every single outlet, as far as Facebook, Blogger, things like that. It was well documented for many, many years that this kid was sort of slowly wasting away and dying.
Well, once you did expose it, how did the people who'd been taken in react?
It was kind of like a bomb went off in the community. I mean, people just exploded and didn't trust anything or anyone. And honestly, when I wrote about the first hoax, I wasn't really prepared for how much it affected people when it came out that the story was not true. I heard from a mother who left the bedside of her dying child to comfort the Durr family when they had a diagnosis of remission in Eli. And now she's looking back and thinking, I left my kid to comfort this person, and this person isn't even real. They formed really intense friendships with the family, and I think that the people who did friend them, a lot of them were struggling with illnesses themselves or illnesses of a family member, and they're in a very vulnerable spot where anybody who's kind of going through the same thing is a friend to them. And to find out that this person wasn't real was very devastating.
So they were friending people in the Durr family, all one person pretty much. Who was the inventor of this Durr family hoax?
Well, it ended up being a 22-year-old med student from Ohio. She had started the family as kind of just a time killer when she was a teenager, and I believe it kind of just snowballed from there. She was interested in medicine and interested in childhood cancer, just, I guess, is something that she was passionate about, and she invented the characters and kind of got lost in this world and sort of lost the plot that there were real people whose lives she was affecting by the story. She and I ended up talking on the phone, and she confessed the whole thing. She apologized to everyone involved, and I do believe she really does feel terrible about it.
Was the Warrior Eli hoax more or less elaborate than others that you've uncovered over the past few years?
This one was particularly elaborate just because it went on for so many years. I mean, I found stuff on the internet going back at least 7 years. When I talked to the person who ended up being behind the hoax, she said it had been going on for 11 years. Something that made it really elaborate was that she had sent out packages to supporters that had a plastic bracelet to draw awareness to Eli's cancer fight. She had printed out pictures and stuff of Eli and wrote on the back and sent that out to supporters. And she sent them out at her own expense all over the world. So to me, that was pretty excessive. Since then, I mean, I've uncovered a lot of other hoaxes, and the people behind them do go to really, really great lengths to make their story seem believable. But that, to me, kind of stuck out, the care packages.
Well, you did publish a written apology from Emily on your website. How did people respond? Did they take it?
No, the response kind of shocked me. To me, I have sympathy for the people that are behind the hoaxes, because I don't think that anybody who's very happy with their life would make 72 fake Facebook profiles and invent a family that has a child that's dying of cancer. People that were affected by it didn't seem to feel like she was remorseful or that the apology was sincere. Eventually, I do think some people are able to forgive them, but it's difficult. I mean, it's really difficult when someone's been deceived and they discover they've been opening up and telling their most intimate secrets to somebody who's been lying about their very identity.
Well, you seem to have a little bit of sympathy for the perpetrators of the hoaxes.
I do. I mean, I don't think that anybody who is in a good place emotionally is doing these things. I've exposed now, I believe, 16 or 17 of these hoaxes. And every single time when I'm doing research, I think, oh, this person is terrible. I can't believe that somebody would do this. When I end up talking to the person behind it, I kind of hear their sad story, and I realize that they're not in good places. I mean, I honestly feel like a lot of them are depressed, and this is a way for them to take social risks without sort of having to step outside their comfort zone. Obviously, that doesn't make what they're doing right, but I do think it's possible to know what they're doing is wrong and to still have sympathy for the person that's doing it.
I'm speaking with Taryn Wright. In her spare time, she hunts down and exposes a very specific type of internet scammer, people who pretend to have serious or terminal diseases sometimes for financial gain, but more often just for the attention. The condition has been called Munchausen by internet. Well, Taryn, now you work with a group of others, the Warrior Eli Hoax Group. Are these people like you who just kind of stumbled into this, or maybe people with a more personal stake or axe to grind because they've been taken in?
It's people that were affected by the first hoax, the Warrior Eli hoax. They were either friends of the Durr family, or they were people who were in the childhood cancer community who knew the Durr family just throughout, you know, the internet presence of that group. Some of them are just researchers in general. Like it was a group that formed pretty organically after I posted on the blog. It was basically as people that are good at researching these things and are kind of passionate about making sure that people aren't hurt by a hoax like this again.
So do you surf the web looking for stories or people that sound suspicious?
They come to me usually. I get a lot of emails from people with different web pages and groups on Facebook to look at to attempt to verify the truth behind it. So we do get a lot of emails, and just every once in a while, just surfing the web on different blogs and stuff, something will pop up and will look fishy to me.
What are some of those fishy-looking or red flag kind of stories?
It's always just very, very dramatic. I mean, I think even in the most awful, terrible cancer battle, there's moments just of tedium and boredom and things like that. In the fake blogs, there's nothing like that. Every day, somebody is coding, somebody's going into a coma. If it's not the patient, then somebody close to them is getting in a car accident. There's always twins involved. Just like very, pretty much the most dramatic plot twists that you can think of always seem to happen in the fake blogs. Like if people are losing attention, it becomes like Sweeps Week, where they have to have something dramatic happen to make the story kind of progress forward.
Well, this has
so
been
that's a definite red
this
flag.
This has been happening for a long time, obviously before the internet. But how do you think that technology has changed or worsened even the nature of these kind of hoaxes?
Well, I just think it's a lot easier now for somebody to make something like this up. I've talked to Dr. Feldman, the psychiatrist who came up with Munchausen by internet, and he said that if people weren't doing this online, they'd be going into hospitals and feigning illnesses to get attention. So I think now instead of having to research and actually take the risk of going into a hospital and maybe being found out, people can just turn on the computer and do 10 minutes of research about, you know, some sort of ailment and create a blog and start faking online. And it's just a little easier and less of a risk.
Imagine when looking for hoaxes, you also do come across a lot of real stories about cancer patients and grieving families and long hospital stays. And wonder, is it difficult for you to spend so much time rifling through such emotionally loaded material?
It is. You know, it's opened my eyes to the fact that people struggle a lot with stuff that I hadn't really given much of a thought to. I mean, childhood cancer, I had no idea I knew it was a terrible thing. I didn't know how widespread it was, and I didn't know exactly how horrific of a fight it is. I've friended a lot of people who I've interacted with while confirming hoaxes, and it's just emotionally loaded, and it's difficult to kind of walk the path of having sympathy for both sides of the aisle. You know, like I do know these people have been lied to, and I do feel terrible about that. And some people get angry at me for being sympathetic towards the people behind the hoaxes. So it's just kind of an emotional minefield signing online every once in a while now.
Well, Taryn, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Taryn Wright, she's a futures trader by day and internet hoax buster by night. She helped to uncover what is now referred to as the Warrior Eli hoax. You'll find a link to read a lot more about her work. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. We guarantee you will not find any fake stories or frauds or hoaxes at wordofmouthradio.org, unless we meant to do it, and they're marked as such. That is also where you can sign up for the Word of Mouth podcast, and you can listen whenever fits your schedule. And if you dig that kind of convenience, please do us a favor and write a review or rate it on iTunes. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I am the authentic Virginia Prescott, inviting you back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.